Well, good evening, everybody. Good to see you. So week three, here we are. And we're picking up on the last of sort of four broad facts that we were representing. And I think what I'll do is just say a quick prayer. And we can dive in, talk through some of this, and then hopefully we'll have time for letting you guys just kind of throw some questions out that we may not have covered. So, God, we're thankful for this evening. Thank you that you brought us here safely, all the blessings you give us. And we live in a very practical world sometimes with what's right in front of us. But underneath everything, Lord, your resurrection is the tipping point of all of history. So we're grateful for that, and we couldn't be more grateful for anything else. And help us to understand for our own strength of faith, but also so that we can minister to others and take us out of our comfort zone and put us in positions to share. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. I had somebody affiliated with our ministry pray for me, and they said, or in their prayer, they said, keep Chris in a spot where he's not qualified and he has to depend on you. I thought, why would you pray that? Don't do that to me. But it's true. It's true. We prepare as much as we can, and then we let God do the rest. So, and he always puts us in a position where the Holy Spirit has to be operative. So, but we will study our little brains out and learn as much as we can. So the three facts so far were Jesus' death by crucifixion by the Romans, the empty tomb being found, especially by the women that were first to the tomb, and then third was the appearances that created belief by the apostles or the disciples and others. The claims of appearances even by Paul and James, the skeptics. And fourth, here we come to origin of the Christian faith. So there's going to be a couple of angles to that. So you will find that in my notes, I sort of tried to take several people's work and sort of codify it a little bit. So something like origin of the Christian faith in my category kind of involves some information from a couple different authors. So I tried to make it a little broader, so I could use a lot of different people's stuff, not just one of them. So if you look at Craig or Habermas, they might phrase it a little different, but you'll get the same basic effect. Okay, so origin of the Christian faith. On the whole, the group of followers, the disciples mainly, I'm talking about here, the transformation of the disciples from disillusioned deserters of Jesus to bold proclaimers of his resurrection, even to the point of death. They were willing martyrs all the way up to the end. So I've listed all those references there. I'm not going to read through them. But if you look at, say, like Tertullian or Dionysius, those ones are going to mention the martyrdom. Those are going to be sources that actually mention that they were martyred. There's always a little bit of debate about who was martyred, how, and when, but there's pretty clear allusions to the martyr, that they were martyred. So that's important to know, that that's actually in the sources, so that if somebody challenges that, you can just take them to the sources after you look them up. So just to highlight that point, I mean, I think we all can remember, say, Peter. This is a prime example, right? He was very gung-ho and ready to go for whatever Jesus had in mind, and then at the last second, he loses his will. And part of this, this will come up when we get to the rival theories. There's a slide that talks about this. But essentially, this just wasn't in their wheelhouse. The jig was up. The guy they were following that was one of the many possible messiahs that had come along over time, was now being crucified by the Romans. So to see them change from being totally disillusioned by that to suddenly turning the world upside down from Jerusalem is quite a transformation that needs to be accounted for. A couple scholars, just to reinforce this, just so we're getting some sort of moderate scholars here. Ben Meyer says that it was the Easter experiences which affected the disciples' transformation is beyond reasonable doubt. And Hugo Staudinger says, only the appearances of Jesus brought about a new change of mood in them. So what we get out of noticing that is that that doesn't necessarily prove anything in and of itself. I mean, a lot of people have sincere beliefs about things and go to extreme lengths. But their willingness to suffer and die is clear, undeniable evidence that their beliefs were sincere. They really believed it. Now, a little pushback, just while we're on this point, if somebody wants to say, like I was just saying, well, you know, you've got modern Muslim martyrs that will bomb, you know, suicide bombings, things like that. Or you can think of, you can think of all sorts of historical examples. Buddhists, I'm trying to remember the years that there was a Buddhist that set himself on fire. Things like that. I mean, you can point to clear examples where somebody believes something so strongly that they're willing to go to great lengths. So what's the tiebreaker? Why is this any different than the others? I mean, at the end of the day, all of those are possible worldviews that could be true, right? These beliefs that people hold so sincerely that they're willing to suffer and die for them, what is going to tell us whether or not one is true and one is false, or which one of them is the one? Well, the difference with Christianity and the resurrection in particular is that it's falsifiable, basically. And a lot of these other claims aren't falsifiable. Like, say that Allah revealed the truth to Muhammad, his prophet. Well, that's fine as a claim. You know, we can leave that up to question, but we're never going to be able to talk about, well, were there some eyewitnesses, and is there some history and some reports that we can look at and judge based on the evidence? Well, Christianity stands alone in offering that. And once you go through the process, as we're doing, it withstands scrutiny. So a couple ways of saying it: it's publicly accessible, and they had evidenced experience, not just religious experience or spiritual experience. They had evidenced experience in addition to those other factors. And we can also note that if you go back and read, you know, Galatians, Acts, and look at the interchange between the early church in Jerusalem and Paul, there's a little bit of funny business at first, because it's like, wait, Paul? Like Saul, who was just killing us? Wait a second. Like, it actually says they were scared of him when he approached them at first. Like, I don't think we want anything to do with you. But through the course of interaction, and through looking at the beliefs of both what Paul was proclaiming and the others, what do we see in common? The resurrection is at the core of what they're proclaiming, and that's where their common ground is. So it's undeniable that at the center of everything was the resurrection. That was the thing that made them cohesive at the end of the day, was their shared belief in the resurrection. This scholar, Helmut Koester, says, what Paul preached was never the subject of controversy between Paul's Gentile mission and the church in Jerusalem. Jesus' death and resurrection was the event upon which their common proclamation was based. Now, one thing I didn't take the time to do, maybe I'll do this to, you know, edit this presentation, but it'd be interesting to go to each of these scholars and sort of see what their pedigree is. And I can't tell you outright that none of them are evangelicals, but I can tell you that not all of them are, and some of them are, you know, moderates or even liberal scholars. So I'm not just you know, cherry picking here. Günther Bornkmann, Bornkam, says the Easter faith of his first disciples was not the peculiar experience of a few enthusiasts or a peculiar theological opinion of a few apostles who in the course of time had the luck to prevail. No, they were all one in the belief and the confession to the risen one. And on some of those previous slides, if you look at those references about the suffering and martyrdom, it's going to reference the same idea, that everybody was on the same page based on their belief in the resurrection. That's what was motivating them to be so willing. That was universal in the early church. Okay, and now we can sort of narrow it down to some individuals here, namely Paul and James. And there may have been others, but these are the ones that we have, you know, the clear evidence about. And maybe I should separate it into two. Maybe Paul should be a persecutor. That's even further than a skeptic, and James could be a skeptic. But Paul, we know of his conversion story from those following references. And then we have tons of information on his suffering and martyrdom. Again, some of these references will reference both their common belief in the resurrection and the suffering and martyrdom of several. Peter's mentioned in there, James, Paul, and it even mentions the apostles in general. So, I mean, this is the notes don't. I don't have any, you know, long sentences here, but I mean, it's a pretty basic essential point. You've got somebody who's a persecutor and a skeptic. I mean, he talks about himself as the foremost of the Pharisees. I mean, he's totally practicing that paradigm, and then something dramatic happened, and here he is proclaiming the resurrection all across the Mediterranean. So that's just yet another aspect of the origin of the Christian faith that has to be accounted for. How do you have a guy like that convert and suffer and be martyred? And then James, you know, Paul's a little more clear, basically just because there's so much text about him. I mean, you can't, the New Testament is mostly Paul. But James, we know in the slide here, oh, I'm sorry, let's see, I've got too many computers. James, it's pretty clear, you know, some of it's indirect or inferred, but it's coherent, that he was unbelieving, basically as part of the nuclear family. He was skeptical with the others. And then in the 1 Corinthians 15 formula, the one about he appeared to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, where it lists the 500, it lists the women, it lists James, it lists and Paul lists himself last. So James is listed in those from the early tradition from the Jerusalem church. So we have him unbelieving, we have him appeared to, and then we have him, the next thing you know, you look at these references and it says he's in charge over in Jerusalem. So that's pretty big change. From being somebody's brother and going, you're crazy, to being the leader of the movement that's following the proclamation of his own, of the person you were skeptical of, his resurrection. And James as well, you can look in these references for his suffering and martyrdom. Right there, next slide. Now, since I have that slide up, just a little note in doing something I learned a bit of, going through some of this, a lot of these references and actually going and looking them up. Some of these are, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Hegesippus or Hegesippus. There are a number of times where there's a work that we know of because somebody like Eusebius is quoting another work, and then you find somebody else quoting that same work. So it's like a work that's lost to history. Like, are you familiar with the Library of Alexandria that was lost? It was burned, and it had like everything. Yeah, I feel so much grief when I think about all the books I could have read out of that library. works that are lost, like there's a Roman historian, and I can't remember the name. I just read this, that because somebody might say, if something so significant happened and was so important, there would be more references to it historically. Well, the problem is we just lose these ancient documents. And there's a Roman historian who wrote 144 volumes on history that are just gone. Well, we don't just think that the history isn't there because the document's lost. There are other documents. And so, for instance, like Tiberius being in charge during the era of Christ, well, there are more references, there are more works that reference Christ than reference Tiberius. So Jesus' existence is more corroborated than Tiberius' existence, or as governor in that area, or whatever his rank was. Or is he, I don't know what he is, emperor, something, Caesar? All right. Come on, technology. That one's freezing up. Oh, well, I guess this slide fits what I was saying earlier about based on their sort of what they were thinking ahead of time before Jesus was crucified. Craig says, it's difficult to overemphasize what a disaster the crucifixion was for the disciples' faith. Jesus' death on the cross spelled the humiliating end of any hopes they had entertained that he was the Messiah. And there are some references we could go into if we had time, just displaying this sort of constant sort of misunderstanding by the followers. Like, they're always asking these questions like they don't. Like, there's one where they ask, well, how is Elijah going to come back before the resurrection? Because their belief was that there was a general resurrection for everybody at the end that was physical, and Elijah would happen. Elijah would come back before that. So they're thinking, okay, what? How's this going to work out then? Because you're talking about resurrection, but the timeline doesn't work. That seems later. So they're confused about. They didn't quite get it until it actually happened. Okay, and then this slide you do not have. That's where I wrote new next to it, so I'd remember to tell you that. And sorry to do that to you, but I added it in because I did a little extra reading this afternoon and thought it would be helpful. There are also social structures that are changed by the followers of Jesus. So we have to remember the context. I mean, you've got the Babylonian captivity, and the other, you had two deportations and then all that exile, and then they come back. You've got a lot of extra law being built up to guard themselves from falling into that pit again. And then you have the Roman occupation. So they've got all sorts of reasons to sort of rally and guard what they have. And you also have oral tradition and, well, just tradition in general, I mean, for thousands of years leading up to this moment. I mean, that's all context for what's happening here. So it's very significant that not only do you just have a few believers, some of this that I was reading was from an interview with J.P. Moreland, so I haven't corroborated his fact that he laid out there, but what he said was that there were upwards of 10,000 believers in Jerusalem after this thing got kicked off. I mean, you have a lot of, and then these aren't you and me. These aren't, well, it's not me, a Gentile from, you know, Whittier, California. These are Jews in the paradigm and context of what I was just saying after that long history. So it's very dramatic in a way that we can't understand because we live in this sort of pluralistic, take it or leave it. You want to be Buddhist? Okay. You want to be a Muslim? Okay. That's cool. these guys were homogenous and Jewish to the core in their culture. So for them to just abandon all these things or change them isn't something where they would just go, oh, I found a new flavor that I like. It's not like that at all. There would have to be something very dramatic. He described it as well, something like this, let's say that you decided that murder was no longer a problem. Like, that's the depth of core conviction that we're talking about, like something that's just totally fundamental to you being shifted. So they got rid of animal sacrifice, which makes sense if they're finally getting it that Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecies. I mean, read Matthew. He obviously finally figured that out. Instead of just Moses' law being the ultimate thing to abide by, there was a realization that that wasn't enough. And Paul talks about that. There was a change from observing the Sabbath in particular to a shift to the day that Jesus rose being the day of meeting. There's a shift from Jewish monotheism, which God is it's essentially one person, one being, to suddenly Jesus is being admitted as divine. That's a huge difference. And again, the expectation was for the Davidic prophecy of a Messiah to come and throw off the Roman occupation and put them back in their right political place. But the early church is now understanding his suffering. So that's a big shift. And then we have added elements of the communion and baptism and the emergence and endurance of the church. So I won't talk much about those for time's sake. So that's essentially the fourth fact in a nutshell. Or a large nutshell. Now, I just want to before I go on, any comments on that section? Yes.
Yeah, all this social things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is our heritage, yeah. Right. Yeah, because they're following Jesus' authority.
But before these things were happening after he resurrected, started to change. Even before he died. You know, in the upper room he already told them.
Mm-hmm.
About his death.
Right. Yeah, you know, I didn't really specifically read about what we know that this is what the early church started doing. I don't know how that played out for the people who were just remained Jewish in their traditions. But yeah, I would assume that they were able to still sacrifice up until they couldn't. and I don't know what the modern state of that is as far as Jewish teaching goes. Right. So as far as I know, if you're not a Messianic Jew or a completed Jew, but just Orthodox Jew, I think that's an expectation that when things are restored, that animal sacrifice would still be reinstituted. Okay. But again, just to bring it back around, the point is, how do you account for all that? All those origins of the belief to the point of death of everybody, especially the skeptics, and then the all these changes that happened very dramatically. Okay. Now, I added this in at the last second as well, but you have this, right? Bias testimony. I think this is really important. I think the other theories that are held up as alternatives are more important than this one. But I think the average person is going to come to this more. They're going to say, it's going to be intuitive to them to say, well, of course they said Jesus rose from the dead. Of course they said he performed miracles. Of course they believed in him. They had a vested interest. They were biased. So we can't really trust them, and we should probably throw out their testimony. So a few things to note about that concept. Here's some problems with that thinking. Let me start with number two. If that's your methodology, then you have to throw out a whole lot of history. In other words, it proves too much. So if you are, come up with any example. If you're a Republican and you say something about politics, then it's got to be thrown out because you're biased. The only people that could say anything about politics would be people who have no bias at all. Well, how could you ever do anything? How could you ever report anything? Yeah. Number one, Paul and James were biased against Christianity to start with, right? So by that same criteria, we even have instances of overcoming that.
What does that mean?
Yes. What does what mean?
That Paul and James were biased against Christianity.
Okay, well, James, as part of the family, is listed as some, the family wasn't going along with what Jesus was saying. They didn't believe.
It was a nut case, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so.
It means Saul, not Paul.
I should say Saul. Yeah, it should say Saul.
And bias means for. Prejudice means against.
I put biased against, but you could put prejudice. It's synonymous.
I was just trying to understand.
Bias just means you're.
Never.
Well, that's fine. We could say biased or prejudice, but the way you're understanding it is correct.
I just tried to understand what you said about Paul, that's all.
Yeah, well, if I said Saul was prejudiced against Christianity before conversion,
yeah,
that would be,
I'm
happy with that edit. Yeah. Number three, bias can work in favor of the account. So in the source I was reading, they used the example of Jewish historians reporting on the Holocaust. Okay. Well, do we say, well, that's not really good evidence for the Holocaust because they're biased because they're the ones being persecuted? Well, that's just bad thinking. They had a reason to be accurate in the recording because it's something important that happened that they need to get right. And that actually works in their favor because they had a privileged perspective that nobody else had as being the ones in the mix, as it were. And number four, we must address the data offered more than the bias of the reporter. Otherwise, we end up with either a genetic fallacy or an ad hominem argument. So anytime that you start to question what I don't want to say is character never matters, but there's a point at which you have to just address the argument on its own merits and not worry about the person behind the facts. The facts stand alone to an extent. So bias only enters so far. Okay, so I'm going to get into some alternative theories. Let's see, what time is it? Okay. If we do this quick enough, we could probably do the alternative theories and then take a break and then come back and do one more little thing and just talk some things out. So the Suin theory idea, or AKA apparent death theory, is that Jesus didn't really die. He passed out and later revived in the tomb. Now, after you're done laughing at them, don't laugh at them. But so problems. It doesn't. We went through pretty extensively the medical reality and the Roman reality of execution. So that doesn't line up with Sunan theory at all. That's a pretty heavy, big mountain to climb to present this theory. Two, a half-dead Jesus would not lead to a belief in a resurrected Messiah. Let me read this quote. David Frederick Strauss. It is impossible that a being who had stolen half-dead out of the sepulcher, who crept about weak and ill, wanting medical treatment, who required bandaging, strengthening, and indulgence, and who still at least yielded to his sufferings, could have given to the disciples the impression that he was a conqueror of death and the grave, the Prince of Life, an impression which lay at the bottom of their future ministry. Such a resuscitation could only have weakened the impression which he had made upon them in life and in death. At the most, could have only given it an elegiac voice, that's like coming from elegy, like talking about somebody that's dead, but could by no possibility have changed their sorrow into enthusiasm, have elevated their reverence into worship. And if I remember correctly, Strauss wrote this in response to the person who came up with that theory first, and that his writing pretty much killed off that theory, no pun intended. Three, the Jews in that context would have thought he survived rather than rose based on a belief in an end times general resurrection. So if their thinking was, okay, this is how the doctrine works, there's going to be this resurrection at the end times, and it's everybody together, and it's physical resurrection, and they saw him, in that haggard state, they would said, oh, well, he survived after all. But that's not what the reports are. And Ford, this doesn't say anything about the conversions of the skeptics. I listed Thomas in there. I was going to add a whole thing about Thomas, but I didn't. So I could just write Paul and James. Oh, let me read a couple of these quotes. Ancient Judaism did not know of an anticipated resurrection as an event of history. Nowhere does one find in the literature anything comparable to the resurrection of Jesus. Certainly resurrections of the dead were known, but these always concerned resuscitations, the return to the earthly life. In no place in Judaic literature does it concern a resurrection to doxa, or that means glory, as an event of history. So there was no place in their belief system. There's no mechanism in place talking about a one-off glorious resurrection in Jesus in his sort of glorified state. And the Journal of the AMA, at the conclusion of an article they wrote about assessing the data about Jesus. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. Amen. Okay, well, maybe the body was stolen. This could be in conjunction or in addition to calling it fraud or conspiracy. The disciples secretly stole the body and lied about the resurrection. Okay, problems. It doesn't account for the embarrassing inclusion, the inclusion of the women at the... What's that? Mm-hmm. Let's see, is that listed in there? It's not, is it? No, that's good, add it to the list. Another point, number two, why would, if you were putting together a good conspiracy and you stole the body so nobody knew that he was really dead, why would you draw attention to that in your records of everything that went on? I mean, they say it right in there that there was an accusation of the body being stolen. Well, if I was going to make a good story, I would just leave that out Why jeopardize my case by adding that in? That doesn't make any sense. Number three, liars. I expanded the way this is said, but the way I read it was, liars make poor martyrs. There's got to be a point at which you give up if it goes too far. In fact, I had that, well, she wasn't lying, but I had a run-in with one of my offspring today where, you know what I told her is I said, look, I know I'm old now, but I was a kid, and I was a kid longer than you are because you're still only 8 or 7. So I have more kid experience, and I can tell, this is way too analytical. I should have just told her she's in trouble, but I couldn't help myself. So I said, I was analyzing the situation. I can tell by the muscles in your eyes that you're forcing yourself to continue to be upset and cry. Because I remember the feeling of being a kid and going, I can't give this up. I got to keep crying. I got to make my case. So at some point when I explained that the consequences were going to remain regardless, she gave up at some point because it wasn't doing anything to get rid of the consequences. So at some point you give up when you know you're going to face something. And I hope she never finds the recording of this. Or maybe I can keep it as blackmail material. Number four, it doesn't fit with the character of the disciples. So everything, we'd have to sort of challenge this whole image of them learning how to be like Christ and being on board with this morality that Jesus had. And they have to suddenly, just all of a sudden, develop a conspiracy. Well, that doesn't fit any of the other data about them. Except for Judas. Five, based on Jewish belief, they had no background beliefs or motive to make up a suffering servant story. We already kind of talked about that. They didn't have the machinery in their belief system for that. And six, it doesn't do anything to account for the conversions of the skeptics. That seems to be a running theme. N.T. Wright sets the context well. He says, if your favorite Messiah got himself crucified, sorry, hold on, what point am I on? That doesn't really fit that slide, does it? Oh, yeah, it does. If your favorite Messiah got himself crucified, then you either went home or else you got yourself a new Messiah. But the idea of stealing Jesus' corpse and saying that God had raised him from the dead is hardly one that would have entered the minds of the disciples. If I told you that, you can question it more, but if N.T. Wright's saying it, then you should believe it. Okay, so this is kind of a smaller one. I added in a couple of smaller ones that I didn't originally have in, just in case you run across it, and to be thorough. Maybe the women and the disciples went to the wrong tomb, found it empty, and then they concluded that Jesus rose from the dead. Okay, well, that's only dealing with the empty tomb. It doesn't do anything about the appearances, or the experiences of appearances. And the fact is that the appearances are really the pivotal thing that created the belief for them. The reason they inferred that the event of the resurrection happened was because Jesus showed up and resurrected, not because of the empty tomb. In fact, if you go ahead and look at the passages, when you go back and look at the empty tomb passages, nobody was convinced quite at that point. They were still questioning, what happened? Where's the body? And John was really the only one listed that was already ready to believe. Three, nobody suggests this other than somebody I think this is from around 1905 or 1910 when this theory came up. That's the first time it's mentioned in all of the literature. Nobody mentions it for two millennia.
Is there any mention of these alternatives in ancient writings?
Well, the main one is the stolen body. The body being stolen is in the second century, and then it's repeated. I don't have an absolute answer. I'd have to go back and double check. But that is the particular one that's the earliest. And these other ones, a lot of them come up much later, like in the 18th and 19th century. So I guess that point could go against those ones as well.
Yes.
It's Celsus in the second century. And in fact, if you look at last week's notes, it's in there somewhere. I think he's another instance of one of those where we know that he wrote and he's referenced several times, but you have to read somebody else's quote of him. Stolen body. I can look up the name for you. It's in one of the books, if you want to know the exact. Around 1900. Yeah. The family tomb of a Jewish leader would be sufficiently well known. I mean, this isn't just anybody's tomb. It's Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, member of the Sanhedrin. And in other words, it'd be like saying, we'll meet at City Hall. Well, everybody knows where that's at. And say, oh, they must have gone to the wrong building. Well, then somebody would have told them they're at the wrong building. That's not City Hall. Everybody knows where City Hall is. Maybe it's not quite that public, but it's something like that. And then five, actually, this one just occurred to me, and I added it in there, even though I didn't read it anywhere. Why think that they would not go to greater lengths to double check before concluding that he rose from the dead? Like, why would you just go to one place? And in fact, they were dubious at first, right? Even in the text. So why think that they just stopped and went, huh, well, I guess he rose from the dead. Like that easily, given all the context that we've already talked about. Yeah. Wouldn't they have been looking for a sealed tomb with Roman guards? Yeah.
Well, when the women left the tomb, they didn't go tell anybody. They just went off.
Well, they went and told the disciples. That's why Peter and John. They went and told the disciples. That's why Peter and John ran back to the tomb.
Okay. Yeah, it gets really. There's a whole separate discussion and work to be done on how the timeline works out with the women. Because of the different accounts, like harmonizing those is an interesting thing, but I'm not even going to try to talk about that. Yes? Sure. I'm trying to avoid that question. Well, does it say that there were no soldiers, or does it just not mention them? Okay. So there's I'm going to respectfully avoid that question for another conversation, because I just listened to a whole talk on that, and there's a whole thing about the time of day and Mary Magdalene's visit versus the group of women's visit, and the word upto, which means a certain thing, and it's a whole bag of worms. Can of worms. Sorry, mixed cliches. Okay, let's see. Let's do this one and then we'll take a break. Displaced body theory. That should have a D, sorry. Typo. Joseph put Jesus' body in his family tomb temporarily. I think this one's around 1902. I'll look it up at break and make sure about that. Joseph put Jesus' body in his family tomb temporarily, but later, like the next day, he moved it to the criminal's graveyard where the body should be, leaving the disciples to infer the resurrection based on the vacant tomb. So they did go to the right tomb, but the body was gone by then because Joseph just put it there temporarily and then took it off to the criminal graveyard. Okay, again, this isn't going to tell you anything. It's not giving any explanation of the appearances or the subsequent belief based on those appearances. And if you look at the customs, you look at the law about the burial laws and the proximity of the criminal's grave to the tomb, it's what I read is it's a maximum of 600 yards away. So there's why would you go, oh, that's so far, I don't want to walk an extra half a mile or whatever. I don't know what 600 yards is. Yeah, that's another element. Mm-hmm. Did you have a comment? And that's the main reason why the stolen body theory is the one referenced early. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, the soldiers are mentioned, yeah. And, you know, the law was unless, I'm going to draw a blank. The law and the custom were once you put the body in, that's it. You don't put the body in and then move it again. So unless there was some extenuating, there's some exception to that rule, but it didn't have anything to do with their situation. And then three, the error by Jesus' followers would have been easily corrected. There's no reason to think that Joseph or his servants would withhold that information. So, I mean, it's what we'll, when we do this a little later, if there's time, the one category is ad hoc. Something is ad hoc when you add it in just to make your explanation work. Otherwise, you wouldn't have that element in there. Well, that's ad hoc to say that, well, the body was moved and nobody said anything about it. Well, why is there any reason to think that unless you're trying to present that specific theory? Okay, so let's stop there, take a break, and come back in 7.5 minutes. All right, so we're back. So I have some information for you. The displaced body theory, the name of the person who originated that is Joseph Klausner, K-L-A-U-S-N-E-R, 1922. And the wrong tomb theory I haven't hunted down yet. It's somewhere in my stack of books. K-L-A-U-S-N-E-R. That's the displaced body theory. Mm-hmm. Both of those theories were sort of non sequiturs, like they didn't gain any traction in scholarship from the get-go, pretty much. Okay, the hallucination theory. And by the way, I'm calling them theories because some people call them theories, but it's probably more accurate to call it a hypothesis because it's less than a theory. It's just like you're making up something and trying to see if it's true or not, like in science. So Craig actually calls them hypotheses. So the hallucination theory is that the disciples believed they saw Jesus, but these were hallucinations. In other words, I should put AKA they were crazy theory or something like that. Number one, the reports of the appearances all claim it was a physical Jesus. There's no hint of it being a figment of their imagination or a vision, even for that matter. In fact, I don't know why I keep doing this because I'm always frustrated when I do it, but I went and looked at some atheist blog. Somebody's saying, I'll defeat the resurrection in two easy steps or whatever. And it's always a little more complicated than that, but they basically said, well, we can throw out Paul's because that was just a vision. Well, nowhere does the evidence say that, or does he claim it, or does, and the scholars don't. That you can argue whether or not it was a physical appearance, But his belief and his experience was of a physical appearance. That is the fact. And then what you do with that is the question. So even Paul, in that more extreme case, where it's later and it's separate from the others, is still a physical appearance in his experience. Number two, group hallucinations don't happen. In other words, hallucinations are an individual event. And let's see, I have a quote in here. This is Habermas. Hallucinations are individual occurrences. By their very nature, only one person can see a hallucination at a time. They certainly aren't something which can be seen by a group of people. Neither is it possible that one person could somehow induce an hallucination in somebody else. Since an hallucination exists only in the subjective, personal sense, it is obvious that others cannot witness it. And then I go on further to say, even if there were group hallucinations, maybe I should say that first and then say there aren't any. Even if there were, how do you account for them? What did I say? Even if there were a variety of individual hallucinations, you say it's not group, but they had similar hallucinations, even though they were separate. How do you make a bunch of hallucinations that are essentially identical? So it's really, practically speaking, no different than making the group hallucination claim. Three, hallucinations, visions, delusions. I could probably make two separate slides for visions and delusions, but we get pretty much the gist of it through the hallucination theory. They would be evidence that he was dead or spiritual, not that he was physically resurrected. Their prior beliefs would inform their hallucinations. So they would believe something like that he was in heaven or he was in what they would call Abraham's bosom, waiting for the resurrection of the righteous. Craig says, given the current Jewish beliefs about life after death, the disciples, were they to project hallucinations of Jesus, would have seen Jesus in heaven or in Abraham's bosom, where the souls of the righteous dead were believed to abide until the resurrection. And such visions would not have caused belief in Jesus' resurrection. Number four, it doesn't address the empty tomb. We'll come up to that in a second, but one of the things is explanatory scope. You need to not only have a powerful explanation, it's got to explain all of the facts. So that's why we kept mentioning it doesn't account for this. You need to have scope, and that the resurrection actually happened covers all the bases. And five, it doesn't do anything to account for the conversions of Paul and James. Okay, well, maybe they just borrowed, and this seems to be apropos today. There's a movie called Zeitgeist, I believe it's called, floating around the internet, and tries to show that this whole thing about Jesus dying and rising is just borrowed from other mythology. Somebody in one of the books called it copycat theory. Jesus' story is borrowed from a former pagan mythology with similar dying and rising elements. Well, problems. It doesn't make any sense given the context of first century Jews in Palestine, which I already mentioned, right? There's a circle the wagons sort of mentality to guard themselves against outside influence, because that's what got them in trouble in the first place, into exile. Two, anything remotely close to Jesus' resurrection story is 100 years later than Jesus, minimum. There should be a comma there. So this is probably the first thing I'd mention. If somebody challenged this and they brought up Osiris or something like that, I'd say, well, that's a very interesting story. Can you go ahead and show me the source material and let's look at it. And when you do that, the evidence shows that the dating of these myths are after Jesus, not before. The pertinent ones. Some of them that are earlier are so dissimilar that it doesn't even, that you don't even have to make that point. Three, the existence of, we call them scare quotes in philosophy when you're using the term similar but you don't really mean it. You mean what other people say is similar even though you don't really believe it's similar. That's what scare quotes are for. The existence of similar stories does not disprove Jesus' resurrection. It stands or falls on its own historical merits. So just the fact of some similar story existing doesn't get you out of having to look at the evidence and make a decision based on the evidence. I mean, you're doing the same thing in those other cases. Why aren't you going to do it in this case? And actually, somebody emailed me a question once about that, and one point I added, and this is just my own idea. I don't know if it, I haven't brought it up to any scholars or anything, but that seems like there's something about the human condition when it's making, whether it's what we believe is what actually happened in Christianity is being the truth, or these other attempts at religion to try and account for our human need, it almost seems like a clue to an innate sense of redemption. Like redemption is what's necessary. We need some sort of help and some sort of being to conquer, whether it be the cosmic elements or our individual elements, our individual problems. You need some power beyond that. So I don't see why that couldn't be actually evidence for the Christian position, because ours is unique, again, that it's evidence, it's falsifiable. So you could show both that we have the evidence, but we also have the common human experience desiring this sort of remedy in us. Maybe that's why nobody includes that one, because it's too hard to say, too wordy. Number four, the nature of resurrection in these other accounts is unclear or dissimilar. So if somebody says, the story in Jesus is just like this other story, again, you press for the sources and compare the two, and you'll find dissimilarities. And five is similar to what we're doing right now, right? We're looking at, okay, well, on face value, they're reporting that the resurrection happened, but it would be sort of ignorant for us not to say, well, is there another explanation? I mean, that's pretty radical, pretty out there. Maybe we should try out these other theories. Well, if you do the same thing with these other myths, they're easily accounted for. But we have a different situation here where these other alternatives don't account for Christ's resurrection in the same way. In other words, there are answers to these other, there are alternatives that work for those myths, but no alternative that works for this story of Jesus. Ronald Nash quote. He says, liberal efforts to undermine the uniqueness of the Christian revelation via claims of a pagan religious influence collapse quickly once a full account of the information is available. In other words, look at the sources and actually look at the actual evidence. The birth and rapid rise of the Christian church remain an unsolved enigma for any historian who refuses to take seriously the only explanation offered by the church. That's a good little quote that sort of wraps up a lot of what we've talked about tonight. Okay, so before we look at that chart, any comments, questions, tell me I'm wrong about any of these theories. Okay. So we're sort of coming full circle, and you know, this chart I probably should have done the first week, but I talked too much about other things. So, but it's not a bad time to use it. And we're not going to like sit here and fill out the whole thing. It's more of a tool, but it illustrates our point. So these are from a historian named McCullough. And it's just illustrating some of the criteria for when we're making a historical inference. So I put the candidates on the left, and then across the top, you can kind of score. You can either just put X's, like pass or fail for each one, or you could come up with some sort of numbering system. But what you're doing is this is a graphic way of weighing all the evidence we've looked at, right? So you say, okay, well, you know, maybe it was hallucination. Let's say maybe it was the wrong tomb. Well, that didn't account for the appearances, and it didn't account for the origin of the Christian faith. So it doesn't seem to have a good explanatory scope, right? Whereas the resurrection itself happening has a full explanatory scope. So you could go through, and it would sort of illustrate. I mean, you basically at the end of it, what you'd have is you'd check all the boxes on resurrection, and the other ones would be spotty. You'd have a mixture of X's and spaces. And just very quickly, just to talk through those categories, explanatory scope, you know, does it account for all the facts? We have four facts that we're talking about. I mean, we could expand that to other historical issues as well, but we're just dealing, again, with the minimal facts. So does it account for those four facts? Explanatory power is sort of like saying, does it, on any one of those given facts, does it explain it well? it might have a really wimpy explanation for it to cover the scope, but not really very powerful explanation. Is it plausible? That means, is it plausible? is it less ad hoc than the other theories? So ad hoc means that essentially what it means is it's sort of gratuitous. Like you add it in just because you need it, and you wouldn't otherwise add it in as a fact, as a part of your explanation. So, for instance, when we talked about the displaced body idea, well, it's sort of ad hoc to think you'd have to add in some other factor, like that they kept quiet about it, which they didn't have any motive to. Either Joseph is going to side with the leaders and tell them so they can defeat the Christian movement, or they would tell the disciples because they're on their side and they want them to know because they're sharing in the sorrow or whatever. I mean, those seem to be the two obvious options. Why would you have this third ad hoc option that they kept quiet? Something like that. It accords with accepted beliefs. So I think a good example of this would be we presented the Roman execution expertise or the medical evidence. Like, does it fit with that stuff or does it not? And then comparative superiority is basically taking everything and saying, this is an important one, and other than one other thing that I'll mention, this is probably the hardest thing on this chart for the actual resurrection, is it needs to not only be better, but remember, we're doing an inference to the best explanation. So it's sort of like Sherlock Holmes, and it's essentially circumstantial in a lot of ways, like a court case would be, right? So if you're going to have a circumstantial case, you have to have a preponderance of evidence, not just a little bit of evidence. So in that same way, you know, you need to have not just an edge on the other theories, you need to be pretty well beyond the other theories in how well evidenced you are, which I do think we have, but we just need to be careful that is part of the inference. So again, yeah, if we were to illustrate it, you have all X's or 10s or high marks for the different facts under the resurrection, and the others would have missing categories there, or poor scores in certain categories like scope or power or ad hocness. Okay, so let me read this. This is just a little attempt to sort of carefully rephrase the whole thing. Summary conclusion. There is considerable good historical evidence accepted by the majority of scholars for the following facts. Jesus Christ was crucified by the Romans and died. The tomb was later found empty by a group of his women followers. A number of people reported that he appeared to them physically after his death, including skeptics. These occurrences led to a belief so sincere that his followers were willing to suffer and die for it. Aside from a metaphysical bias against the resurrection, aside from a metaphysical prejudice against the resurrection, just to clarify, I'll switch over to saying that from now on. There is no theory available that provides a better explanation for these facts than the resurrection itself. In fact, while the resurrection hypothesis accounts well for all these facts, the rival theories each have explanatory gaps or implausibilities, leaving them with much less explanatory power and scope. Given the evidence we have, it is most reasonable to infer, considering the historical evidence, that Jesus was raised from the dead. So just carry that in your wallet. Just kidding. Now, just one quick point. There's a good philosopher's disclaimer in there, where I say, aside from a metaphysical bias against the resurrection, okay, so that's the loophole, which is a whole other discussion. I mean, I bracketed the other discussion about the timeline of the women, right? Because it's important, but it's not directly involved in this situation. So another indirect thing is the metaphysical bias. So if we're going to step outside of just the facts and talk philosophically and the nature of history, the nature of miracles, the nature of the supernatural versus the natural, we're going to butt our head up against this question of miracles. And we're going to have this whole discussion of basically the response from the naturalist, or the person that doesn't believe in the supernatural at all, is no matter how much evidence you pile up, it's going to be more reasonable for me to think it didn't happen because I believe only the natural exists. So that's the metaphysical bias I'm talking about. If you come to the table, gosh, I always mix my cliches. If you come to the table with that bias, then I can't tell you, there's nothing I can tell you to convince you, because you're stuck at that point. So that's another philosophical point that has to be discussed on the side. But just in a nutshell, I think a genial way of dealing with that is to say, I'll say it a complicated way and then a simple way. The complicated way would be to say, shouldn't our physics precede our metaphysics? In other words, don't we sort of do the experiment and then conclude the nature of things? Or in this case, don't we assess the evidence and see what actually happened based on that evidence and then make our metaphysical claims, rather than the other way around? Because otherwise, basically, you're in a position where you've closed off inquiry and you could never be convinced. One of my first classes with J.P. Moreland, he said, yes, of course, you know, we're all in this room and we're studying philosophy as Christians because we think it's really important and we want to, you know, help people and all that. But we always have to have defeasibility. That's the bigger word. That you always have to reserve that it's not certain. I don't mean that in an emotional or spiritual way. I just mean in an evidential way. So there's a sense in which you're not being honest with the evidence if you've already concluded that it can't be any other way before you've done the inquiry. So a Christian and a non-Christian or an atheist or a skeptic can be guilty of that. So the beauty is, as Christians, we can follow the evidence where it lies and it will all play out because we have the witness of the Holy Spirit, which is guarding us in truth. And what happens is we have the tiebreaker of the historical evidence and other evidences, science, history, philosophy. And what constantly happens is there's corroboration between the two. So the Holy Spirit is really the instigator of our transformation. Yet, just as you would expect, if he's giving us the truth, it tends to match up with our other truth inquiries in the physical world. So I'll stop talking and see what questions you might want to discuss.
I think the college alternative is hypotheses. You give them a lot of weight. They just appear to be conclusionary ideas, and that's all.
Yeah. Or
there are absolutely no facts
yeah.
to back them up, except someone comes up with this idea, and that's his conclusion.
Right. And what they're doing is, go ahead.
I was going to say, what happens is you're talking to the skeptical person, and they're going to hit you with it. So it's nice to know they exist, and here's the explanation.
Yeah, but they have no facts.
Right, but they're still going to tell.
So that's part of the point I'm making at the end here was, if your starting point is, I'm rejecting the supernatural outright, and anything miraculous or any funny business like that, I'm not going to accept, then anything I can come up with to try to explain the historical evidence is going to be superior for me than what you're telling me. So that's why I'm saying that's a separate issue, a separate discussion on the problem of miracles. But you can ask somebody, you know, something like, well, would anything ever convince you? I mean, some people say, well, you know, if he wrote my name across the sky, like, you know, Chris, I exist. But then, I mean, you can, if you push somebody hard enough, you can probably find a reason why they'd reject that too, like they were hallucinating or...
I have a friend who insisted that he had to see Jesus personally, just like Paul did. Mm-hmm. And he said, other Thomas, he said, I'm doubting Thomas, but I see him, and that's why he believed.
Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts? Any other questions, comments? Awesome. Yeah, I left you plenty of things to read to go find those. If you start to search for some of those antique documents, you'll see there's two or three sites that will pop up all the time that have pretty much all of those. One is like New Advent, it's like a Catholic site. Another is Early Christian Documents dot something. So.
You're familiar with Mithras?
Yeah, I've heard that. I don't know if I've used it.
Do you know if it was written after the birth or before?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, don't know that one. Mithras. I'll make myself a note though. So you won't get an answer, but the next person that asks me that will.
Well, Mithras was supposedly a god that was born on December 25th of a virgin.
Oh, brother.
And they celebrated Mithras in Rome.
Hmm.
And because it was a much larger celebration, the early Christians didn't do us any favors by taking their celebration of Christ to Rome because of the great celebration.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, which came first?
Yeah. Well, I've seen the case put both ways. I mean, whether it's the Christmas dating or other things, I've seen people try to guard the Christian origin of it, and people guard a co-opted, you know, pagan connection. So I'm sort of agnostic about that.
I don't know if I've got all this straight, but my understanding was that some of this kind of stuff, like the December 25th, or some of the things in Christianity that we think of today, given that they were celebrating Jesus' birth back in the early church, it didn't come about to 300 years later or something that they started incorporating, you know, when the Roman Empire became, Christianity became almost the state religion or accepted in any case, they started making stuff that, the people would go for.
Hmm. I'll have to read up on that. I'll make myself notes.
That's how I thought a lot of this stuff came about, that had similarities to pagan things, is that it wasn't really celebrated that way by the true early Christians, but later, you know, the customs changed to fit in with some of the pagan customs.
Yeah. Well, having kids myself, younger kids, and thinking about, okay, I don't know who put me in charge, but I have to help them figure out their own beliefs and teach them while they're young. And so I've been through quite the ringer of figuring out what holidays came from where, and do we celebrate Halloween and the Easter Bunny, and how does that work? And at the end of the day, one thing I realized is that it's a fallacy to, I referred to this earlier, the genetic fallacy is to say, because of where something came from, it's wrong. Well, I think that's the issue we have with some holidays now is, there may be a connection in its origin, but logically speaking, if that is not your connection now, then that's just the genetic fallacy to say, because somebody has fun, I don't even celebrate Halloween, I don't know why I'm defending it, but if a kid dresses up like Cinderella because she enjoys it and she likes getting a little bit of candy, that has nothing to do with the Druids. Now, there may be strains of it where there's evil involved and Druids, fine. I'm just saying that's a genetic fallacy to say because of its origin at some point in the past, therefore, its practice is wrong today. Anyways, okay, well, it's time. Thank you, guys. If you want to ask me any more questions about this topic, I can give you my card with my email on it, and you can email me. And in fact, yeah, I'm going to write down wrong tomb theory so I can look that up. All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.